KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The judges in this country are acting erroneously.
We'll profile James Boasberg, the federal judge President Trump wants to impeach after he ruled to block deportation flights.
Today is Thursday, March 20th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Ahead this hour, we stop by a town hall in Golden, Colorado,
where people had this question for visiting members of Congress. What's the plan to fight back against the Trump administration?
Just because we're not in power does not mean we're powerless. And I think that that is the frustration that people feel right now.
Also, the Israeli military expands its ground offensive in Gaza.
And get ready, the season finale of Severance is about to drop.
My wife's being held prisoner at Lumen, and I just got brain surgery in my basement. How have you been?
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump has signed an executive order to begin dismantling the Department of Education. During his campaign, Trump promised to turn over at least some of the agency's responsibilities to the states, as well as push for support for private schools. NPR's Corey Turner reports.
The White House is making very clear this is part of an effort to expand school choice across the country, including private school choice. President Trump has been a big champion of creating a federal tax credit to help families pay for private school tuition. Mm-hmm. Democrats would certainly oppose a move like that. I think overall, we're seeing the Trump administration really try to shake the foundation of the nation's public education system right now.
It's not clear whether Trump has the authority to actually dismantle the department. It would take an act of Congress to shutter it. The White House says the Education Department won't entirely close right away, continuing to oversee things like federal student loans and Pell Grants. A federal judge in Maryland has blocked billionaire Elon Musk's team from accessing personal data at the Social Security Administration. The court also ruled members of his team, dubbed the Department of Government Efficiency, have to delete any personally identifiable information they've collected. More from NPR's Ashley Lopez.
In her ruling, Judge Ellen Lipton Hollander wrote that Musk's team has essentially been engaged in what she called a fishing expedition at the Social Security Administration. And this expedition, she wrote, has been based on little more than suspicion of fraud. The judge also noted that the agency gave members of Musk's team, quote, unbridled access to the personal and private data of millions of Americans. That includes Social Security numbers, medical records, and bank and credit card information. And while the court has now limited DOJ's access to much of that information, it does say that the agency is still allowed to hand over data that adheres to federal privacy laws. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
The Justice Department has charged three people involved in violent attacks on Tesla locations across the U.S., labeling the acts as domestic terrorism. Attorney General Pam Bondi says defendants are facing prison sentences ranging from 5 to 20 years. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports.
One of the suspects is charged with throwing Molotov cocktails at a Tesla dealership in Oregon while armed with an AR-15 rifle. Another person is facing charges for attempting to ignite Tesla vehicles at a location in Colorado. The Justice Department has charged a third person in South Carolina with vandalizing Tesla charging stations with messages against President Trump before setting them on fire. Authorities have linked the attacks at Tesla locations to anger over the seemingly arbitrary firings of tens of thousands of people overseen by Tesla's CEO Elon Musk. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks closed lower today. The Dow was down 11 points. The Nasdaq fell 59 points. This is NPR. In one respect, even years after the start of the coronavirus pandemic, work life still has not returned to normal. A survey by Gallup looking at the workplace 5 years after the start of the pandemic finds many workers, even with a return to normalcy, still feel disconnected from their organization's purpose and are not clear on how to meet workplace expectations. Less than half of U.S. employees participating in the survey say they strongly agreed they knew what was expected of them at work. Meanwhile, Finland again has been named the world's happiest country, making it the eighth time in a row for the Nordic nation. Terry Schultz reports European countries keep the top spots in the annual survey of well-being, while the U.S. has dropped precipitously.
The World Happiness Report tracks how people in more than 140 countries feel about their lives. This year, Finland, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden, and the Netherlands round out the top five, with Costa Rica, Israel, and Mexico the only non-European countries in the top 10. The survey is done by Gallup and the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network. Gallup CEO John Clifton says data proves happiness is not based on wealth.
One of the greatest correlates to seeing what makes life great is whether or not you live in a society that has community and where people feel safe.
Afghanistan ranks last. The U.S. dropped one spot to its lowest ever position at 24. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
According to a new study, certain blood tests for ovarian cancer can miss Black and Native American patients. The study published today in JAMA Network Open. Researchers looked at data for more than 200 women. Black and Native Americans were 23% less likely to have an elected level blood testing compared with white patients. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Jane Gross, whose bequest supports NPR's commitment to creating a more informed public by distributing programming that meets the highest standards of public service and journalism. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. The federal judge who hit pause on one of President Trump's immigration plans is attracting a lot of attention. Judge James Boasberg of Washington, D.C. is facing calls for his impeachment simply because he ruled against the White House. NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson has been covering the judge for some time. She's here to spend some time with us and tell us what she's learned. Hey, Carrie.
Hey there.
Introduce us more fully to Judge Boasberg.
His name is James Boasberg, but his friends call him Jeb. He actually shared a house with future Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh when they attended Yale Law School together.
Wow.
And Boasberg served for more than 5 years as a prosecutor when he took on some of the toughest homicide cases in D.C. in the late 1990s. NPR spoke with a friend of the judge. His name is Ron Machen, and he shared an office with the judge back when they were prosecutors. Here's what Machen told me.
You know, this is a guy that's devoted his life to public service, that could be the managing partner of probably any firm in the city, making millions of dollars, but he has devoted his life to serving the people.
Boasberg first became a judge when a Republican president, George W. Bush, appointed him to the municipal court here in Washington many years ago.
Huh. So he was initially appointed by a Republican president. Interesting, because the current Republican president is calling him, and I quote, a radical left lunatic. What has been his record on the bench?
I should note the Senate unanimously confirmed Boasberg to the federal court in 2011 during the Obama years. That vote was 96-0. And since then, he's ruled both for and against Donald Trump and Trump's interests. One of his biggest rulings as chief judge of the district court here in D.C. paved the way for a grand jury testimony by former Vice President Mike Pence. That was part of the investigation of Trump's role in the attack on the U.S. Capitol 4 years ago. But the judge has also sided with Trump years earlier in a dispute about Trump's personal tax returns. And Boasberg also ordered the government to review thousands of Hillary Clinton's emails, part of an investigation into her use of a personal server when she was Secretary of State.
Now, in this current moment, it's a case about immigration that has got the judge in the national spotlight. What's at stake in that case?
This is a fight over the Trump administration's use of the Alien Enemies Act to deport hundreds of alleged Venezuelan gang members to El Salvador. It's not clear how many of those men actually belonged to that gang or that they had any prior criminal record. The judges said these are really difficult issues because the president has a lot of power over immigration and national security. The judge did decide to put a temporary pause on the flights out of the U.S., but the government may have flouted one of his orders he gave from the bench to stop flights or turn around planes that already were in the air.
Right. And how's the judge responded?
Boasberg has been demanding some specific answers from the Justice Department about that, but DOJ doesn't want to provide everything the judge has asked for. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt said this week, tens of millions of Americans had voted for Trump's tough immigration plans. Here's more of what she had to say.
The judges in this country are acting erroneously. We have judges who are acting as partisan activists from the bench. They are trying to dictate policy from the President of the United States. They are trying to clearly slow walk this administration's agenda, and it's unacceptable.
Carrie, as we can hear there, things have escalated really quickly to the point that there are now calls, including from the president, to impeach this judge. And the judiciary is pushing back against that?
That's right. A Republican lawmaker from Texas this week introduced articles of impeachment against Judge Boasberg. There have only been 15 impeachments of federal judges in history, mostly for things like taking bribes or corruption. And to actually remove a judge would require a two-thirds vote of the Senate. That won't happen given the math in the Senate this year, but even the threat of impeachment is a problem, according to current and former judges.
And why is that? What are you hearing from people inside the judiciary?
Well, Chief Justice John Roberts actually took the rare step of speaking out to say impeachment is not an appropriate response when you disagree with a judge's decision. That's what the appeals process is for, he said. Trump allies are nonetheless proposing impeachment of at least half a dozen other judges who've ruled against Trump or the Doge team this year. Judges tell me they're worried about this heated rhetoric. They're really worried that could lead to violence against themselves or their families.
And here's Carrie Johnson. Thanks, Carrie.
Thanks for having me.
Seals spend most of their time underwater, but rarely do they drown. A new study in the journal Science reveals the unusual way that these diving mammals can tell when they would run out of oxygen. NPR's Jonathan Lambert has more.
In 2019, ecologist Christopher McKnight took a break from studying seals to study humans at the Free Diving World Championships.
In the first day, I think there were three divers blacked out underwater, so basically ran too low on oxygen, lost consciousness. To me, that was quite jarring to observe, but for the free divers, it was just like, oh, it just happens, you know, it's a thing.
It's a thing in part because free divers can hack their body into thinking it's got more air than it does by hyperventilating. That lowers carbon dioxide, which rapidly increases when we hold our breath, driving the urge to breathe.
Seeing the fallibilities in oxygen management in humans sort of posed the question that I guess I hadn't really thought about in seals.
That question is essentially, why don't these mammals drown? It's true that seals can store tons of oxygen in their bodies, which helps them stay under for up to 30 minutes.
But it doesn't really matter how much you have if you don't know where you are in the fuel gauge. It just takes you to go over that once, and your fitness is zero. You're out of the population.
There are essentially two gases that could serve as this fuel gauge, carbon dioxide, or CO2, and oxygen, also called O2. While mammals' bodies can respond to both, in most circumstances, mammals only detect changes in CO2. That's because CO2 can build up in harmful ways before we run out of oxygen. But
I think when we flip to animals that live the majority of their life in an oxygen-limited system, then O2 is the one that makes most sense to be able to perceive or detect.
But it's never been shown that animals can cognitively perceive oxygen in that way. To find out, McKnight and his team at the University of St. Andrews had to get creative.
Effectively, what we wanted to do was to be able to control the amount of oxygen and CO2 that the animals were inhaling to then affect the amount that is in their blood.
They used an experimental setup where captured gray seals came up to breathe in a special air chamber before diving for food in an enclosed pool. They then exposed seals to high CO2, high oxygen, low oxygen, and ambient air, watching to see how long they stayed underwater.
If we increased the oxygen available to them, dive duration was longer. If we halved oxygen, we find that the dives were shorter.
But when they increased CO2 to 200 times the amount in ambient air,
dive duration was exactly the same, which was a real surprise because it has such a strong perceptible effect on most mammals.
The results pretty clearly show that these seals can directly perceive their circulating oxygen levels, says Michael Tift, a biologist at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington.
It's a little bit of a surprising result, but actually it's also not that surprising of a result.
Seals have been shown to handle big swings in CO2 during dives, so it makes sense to him that they'd pay more attention to oxygen. How they do that wasn't assessed in this study, but McKnight has some ideas. All mammals have basically the same hardware for measuring oxygen and CO2. What's changing, essentially, could be the software.
So what we think is there's a little bit, potentially a reconfiguration of how that information is processed.
To McKnight, that raises the possibility that other diving mammals, and maybe even diving reptiles and birds, have evolved similar ways of not drowning. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
A study out today makes the case for scrapping admission fees to art museums. But as NPR's Chloe Veltman reports, going free does not make sense for all museums.
High entry fees are a major reason why people don't go to art museums. Homer Simpson pushed back against any fee in this 1998 episode of The Simpsons.
What do you mean by suggested donation?
You pay any amount you wish, sir.
And what if I wish to pay zero?
A new study from the think tank ReMuseum suggests most museums should be free. Stephen Riley is the founding director.
Museums are not businesses. They're philanthropic institutions providing a public good for people.
Riley says if that good is providing public access to art, then museums should be focusing on getting more of the public through their doors.
The critical question is, what do museums want to subsidize? Do they want to subsidize more art storage, or do they want to subsidize more access for visitors?
And to get more visitors, free is the magic number. ReMuseum's analysis of more than 150 art museums shows that institutions that do not charge admission have a cost per visitor that's around $10 less than those that do. This is particularly true for the many museums in small to mid-sized municipalities. Among them, the Wichita Art Museum in Kansas. Molly McPherson is its director and CEO.
Going to free admission was the right thing for us to do.
McPherson says the museum did away with its $10 standard entry fee in 2023. The fee amounted to only 1% of the museum's operating budget.
Before, certainly we had attendance at big special events, not necessarily people in the galleries looking at the art. Now we have a steady stream every day.
But nixing entry tickets doesn't make sense for all museums. Like, say, if you're the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York, and a quarter of your budget comes from ticket sales. General admission is $30. Scott Rothkopf is the director.
On the one hand, that might seem expensive and out of reach to some people. On the other hand, it's still a heavily subsidized price.
Rothkopf says the museum relies on sources like its donors and endowment to make up the difference. Yet the Whitney also offers discounts, such as free admission for anyone 25 and under. Rothkopf says these grant-funded programs are successful in reaching new audiences.
Free admission has been a real driver we've seen in increasing the youth of our audience.
Rothkopf says the Whitney has no plans to abandon entry fees entirely, and the ReMuseum study doesn't offer solutions for how museums that do decide to stop charging admission might make up for the income loss. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. NPR has been investigating a debacle within the Department of Veterans Affairs that left thousands of vets on the verge of losing their homes. After our first stories aired, the VA halted foreclosures and stood up a rescue program. We can now report that 15,000 veterans have so far been saved from losing their homes and have new affordable mortgages. But there's also a movement in Congress that could kill the rescue program, as NPR's Chris Arnold and Quill Lawrence report.
Kevin and Jenny Conlon live in upstate New York, not too far from where Kevin was stationed with the Army at Fort Drum.
Jenny says they had a young kid and were struggling to pay rent and save money. Getting a VA loan meant that they could buy a house with no down payment. That was 12 years ago.
Yeah, that's the longest I've been in one place.
Yeah, and without the VA loan, there was no way that we could have afforded to buy a house, especially the house we're in, the school district that we're in.
And Kevin needed that stability. He had served two tours in Iraq almost back to back. His truck hit multiple roadside bombs that left him with traumatic brain injuries. And his best friend on the second tour died. He saw a suicide bomber bear hugged him to the ground, giving his life to protect his buddies. Losing that friend and the survivor's guilt that came with it wounded Kevin Conlon as bad as the bombs.
He's struggled with PTSD, thoughts of suicide. It's taken him most of the past 20 years to be okay.
I am now. You know, for a long time, I was not.
It was because of the forbearance, actually. That's why we needed it. So he could go inpatient at a veterans program.
Jenny's talking about what's called a mortgage forbearance. Basically, it's a way to stop paying your mortgage when you're having a financial hardship and then have an affordable way to start paying again when you're back on your feet.
But like tens of thousands of other veterans, the Conlins got stranded when the VA pulled the plug on a key part of the program. That had allowed vets to bundle their missed payments up and move them to the back of their loan term to get current. And vets lost that option right as mortgage rates doubled to 7%. So basically refinancing wasn't possible either.
So the Conlins have been falling farther and farther behind and are very scared about losing this house.
There's nowhere to go.
I joined right after September 11th. I was willing to die for what I believed in, and for someone in a position that can take away the home that my family live in, like, we've paid enough. We've really paid enough.
When NPR first exposed this problem, there were so many vets in the same boat, about 40,000, that the VA halted foreclosures across the country for an entire year while it rolled out a rescue program.
Good morning. The subcommittee will come to order. Welcome the witnesses and subcommittee members to today.
At a hearing in Congress last week, it came out that the VA has rescued 15,000 veterans so far from the VA's own mistake.
That's 15,000 vets and their families that now have a new low-interest loan from the VA that they can afford so they can keep their homes.
But there are still a lot of other veterans, like the Conlins, left waiting to get approved for this new loan program. And some Republicans in Congress want to get rid of it.
This was a last resort option for our veterans.
I understand the whole developmental process of this and is moronic.
That's Republican Derek Van Orden interrupting the VA's John Bell, who runs the home loan program.
Congressman Van Orden doesn't like that this rescue program works by having the VA itself buy these delinquent loans from the mortgage industry. He thinks that's too risky for the VA.
It gets rid of a bum loan and it passes it off to the American taxpayers.
Van Orden has introduced two bills. One would allow vets who are behind on their mortgages to get current again in a different way, basically restarting what the VA pulled the plug on a few years ago, stranding all these vets. And pretty much everybody likes that idea, housing advocates and the mortgage industry.
But Van Orden has another bill, and that one would cap the VA's rescue program, which is called VASP, at just a couple of hundred loans a year, which would basically kill this program. At the hearing, Elizabeth Balsay from the Mortgage Bankers Association said that'd be a disaster.
Without VASP, VA would have foreclosed on tens of thousands of borrowers. MBA strongly opposes an arbitrary cap of 250 loans per fiscal year.
Balsay was asked, with tens of thousands of vets still behind on their mortgages, what would happen if the VASP program was so severely cut back, especially if it happens before the VA stands up an alternative?
Foreclosure. Oh. I mean, that's, yeah. You know.
Period.
Period. That's really where it's going to come to. The short answer is foreclosure.
Meanwhile, Kevin Conlon hopes that Congress doesn't scrap the rescue program before he and thousands of other vets can get current on their loans again.
You're talking about getting rid of something that would keep me and my family in a home that we love, that we need. And to do that to us is just, it's intentionally cruel.
All this is happening while the Trump administration is firing thousands of VA employees, which could slow the program down. At the hearing, the VA's John Bell said he couldn't say how many of those firings are in the home loan division. And he had no comment on either of the bills.
So a lot is up in the air for thousands of vets who don't want to lose their homes. Chris Arnolds
and Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
The season finale of Severance, the hit drama series on Apple TV Plus, is being released this week. NPR TV critic Eric Dagans notes that the program's second season has become the most watched series on Apple TV Plus.
Fans of Severance will remember last season ended with an anguished shout, which became a rallying cry for current episodes.
She's alive!
That was Adam Scott's character, Mark Scout, who works for the shadowy, cult-like company Lumen. He's undergone a procedure severing his workplace memories from life outside the office, creating two people in one body, an innie and an outie. Outie Mark thought his wife died in a car crash. Turns out she's still alive, held inside the company, requiring the efforts of both innie and outie Mark to rescue her. The show's twisty storylines have paid off. In February, the streamer told Deadline that Severance began its second season as the platform's number one series in history. In last week's episode, a desperate Audi Mark even considers teaming with Patricia Arquette's brutal manager at Lumen, who was fired.
My wife's being held prisoner at Lumen, and I just got brain surgery in my basement. How have you been?
We're allies now. There's no need to.
Oh, we're allies. Sorry. I guess I'm confused.
We don't even know if he's completed the file yet.
What file?
Cold Harbor. And if you've completed it, she's already dead.
What is this Cold Harbor file? Can Mark save his wife and himself from a corporation that's exploited them both? These are the questions fans hope to see answered in the season finale, which streams globally on Friday, wrapping up one of the most visually adventurous and conceptually mind-bending seasons of TV around. Eric Deggans, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Americans say they're more and more worried about bird flu as the virus has spread to some humans. But new research suggests that defenses built up from past flu seasons may help protect us against bird flu.
While this is a bit of a silver lining, this does not mean that we should all feel like we're safe.
That story on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. If you are feeling lonely, there's an app for that.
Yeah, but as you might have guessed, those apps only lead to more loneliness.
All of a sudden, these social media platforms that are supposedly about human connection end up prioritizing kind of the opposite of that.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Making good on a campaign promise, President Trump signed an executive order today to begin dismantling the Department of Education, which has already laid off hundreds of staff.
Beyond these core necessities, my administration will take all lawful steps to shut down the department. We're going to shut it down and shut it down as quickly as possible. It's doing us no good. We want to return our students to the states where just some of the governors here are so happy about this. They want education to come back.
Trump cited reading and math scores that declined during the pandemic as one of the reasons to close down the education department. The president's order will vastly scale down the agency, but it can't entirely eliminate it because that would require an act of Congress. Meantime, the White House says funding for Pell Grants, Title I resources, and for students with disabilities and special needs will be managed by other departments and agencies. A large group of Jewish academics and university staff have signed a letter criticizing the administration for arresting a Columbia University graduate student. NPR's Jason DeRose says it also calls on the school to protect students' First Amendment rights.
The letter begins, "Not in our name," and says the signers hold a variety of views about Israel and Palestinians, but it says they are united in denouncing, quote, cynical claims of anti-Semitism. The letter goes on to reject rhetoric that labels people as anti-Semitic terrorists because they advocate for Palestinian human rights. It says the arrest of Mahmoud Khalil marks a disturbing escalation by the Trump administration, and it calls on universities across the U.S. to cease voluntary collaboration with federal immigration enforcement. The more than 2,400 signers include faculty and staff from across the country, from small liberal arts colleges to large state schools and Ivy League universities.
That's Jason DeRose. This is NPR. We don't remember much from when we were babies, but is that because we don't make memories when we're infants? Science reporter Ari Daniel says new research may hold the answer.
One of the hardest parts of this study was getting the babies into the fMRI machine.
Infants in many ways are the worst possible, you know, subject population.
That's Yale cognitive neuroscientist Nick Turk-Brown. His team showed infants a series of images they'd never seen before while snapping photos of their brains, including the hippocampus.
A region that we know is super important for memory in adults.
Tristan Yates is a cognitive neuroscientist at Columbia. The more active the hippocampus was when seeing an image for the first time, the more likely babies were to remember it later, meaning that infants seem to form memories. Whether we can retrieve them later in life remains an open question. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
A new research study finds blood tests for ovarian cancer may be contributing to health disparities among Black and Native American patients. A study of more than 200,000 women found Black and Native Americans were 23% less likely to have an elevated blood level than white patients, delaying their treatment. Researchers say this suggests the thresholds are too high, and any new data could be jeopardized by White House efforts to do away with DEI programs. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dignity Memorial, helping families today to protect their loved ones tomorrow. Planning celebrations of life in advance can give families peace of mind. Learn more at dignitymemorial.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Sirens wailed across Tel Aviv today as the Houthis in Yemen and Hamas in Gaza fired at the Israeli city for the first time in months. This was the first military response from Hamas since Israel broke the ceasefire in Gaza earlier this week and resumed the war there. Israeli strikes have so far killed more than 500 Palestinians since Tuesday, including many children, and they've wounded hundreds more, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. NPR's Hadil Alshalchi joins us now with the latest from Tel Aviv. Hi, Hadil.
Hello.
Okay, so it was a really early morning for all of you in Tel Aviv, right?
Yeah, that's right. So the first siren went off at around 4 a.m. Israel time. You know, people scrambled to the shelters in their buildings, their neighborhoods. The Iran-backed Houthis later claimed responsibility for firing a missile from Yemen, and they said their target was Ben-Gurion Airport. It saw some disruption to flights, but then it got up and running very quickly. And then in the mid-afternoon, more sirens rang across the city, and you could hear these very loud explosions in the sky, and those were the rockets being intercepted by the very powerful Israeli Iron Dome missile defense system. The Israeli military said the afternoon projectiles, which Hamas claimed responsibility for, were fired from southern Gaza, and they were all intercepted or fell into open areas, and there were no casualties.
And as we said, this is the first response from Hamas since Israel ended the ceasefire on Tuesday. And yesterday, an Israeli ground invasion started. What do we know about that operation?
Right. So Israel is calling this, quote, limited ground operation into central and southern Gaza. It says it wants to expand its security perimeter that separates Gaza from southern Israel. The Israeli military also said that it had taken parts of the Netzarim corridor, which divides south and north Gaza. This is a fortified strip of land that troops had withdrawn from at the beginning of the ceasefire in January. And this is, you know, making Palestinians worried that the passage between the north and the south will be shut off again, like it was earlier in the war, separating people from their homes, their families.
Yeah. Can you tell us more about what you are hearing from Palestinians living in Gaza right now?
I mean, Elsa, there is a lot of fear. NPR's Gaza producer, Enes Baba, was at the Indonesian hospital in Beit Lahia in the north today. The town was struck by Israeli warplanes overnight. Health officials said dozens were killed there, including entire families. At the hospital, Enes said that the floors were covered in blood, bodies laid on the ground, wrapped in shrouds. Enes spoke to Yusuf Abu Habiba there. Abu Habiba says, we were just sitting at home just before dawn when the strikes happened. There was one, then two, then a third strike. He says his brother and other relatives were all killed.
Hadil, can you just explain for us, as far as we know, why did Israel end the ceasefire and resume the war?
So this is a pressure tactic to get Hamas to accept an extension of the first phase of the ceasefire deal. Let me just remind you, the first phase ended on March 1st. Over 6 weeks, Hamas released 33 hostages. Israel freed almost 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees from Israeli jails. And then the second phase was supposed to have seen a total withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza and a permanent end to the war. But instead of starting those second phase talks, Israel came back and said it wanted this extension of the first phase, where it demanded Hamas return half the living hostages still held in Gaza. Hamas said it had held up its part of the deal, refused the extension, and so Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ordered the resumption of the war. And just today, the White House said that President Trump, quote, fully supports Israel and the Israeli military and the actions that they've taken in Gaza in recent days.
That is NPR's Hadil Alshalchi in Tel Aviv. Thank you so much, Hadil.
You're very welcome.
Democrats in Congress are holding town halls around the country. They're hearing grievances from their constituents about the actions of the Trump administration and how the Democratic Party is responding. NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt reports on one town hall in Colorado.
19-year-old Jackson Armento was one of nearly 1,000 people who gathered in Golden, Colorado, about 15 miles west of Denver, to hear directly from Democrats they elected about what's happening in Washington. Armento worries Republican plans could put programs like Medicaid on the chopping block.
My grandma, she's 70 years old and has to work 40 hours to even survive day to day, and my mom has double upper extremity limb loss, and so she's on disability, and that's how she survives. We just want to make sure our family's gonna, I guess, make it through the next 4 years. As dramatic as that sounds, everything's really scary right now.
Armenta's concerned Democrats don't have a unified strategy of fighting back, pointing to a vote last week on a GOP spending bill. All but one House Democrat voted against it, but 10 Democrats in the Senate, led by Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, voted to advance it, saying the bill was bad, but a government shutdown would be worse. Armenta said that if that was the thinking all along, then leaders should have made that clear.
It felt like, you know, leading up to the vote, it was, we're going to fight this, we will shut the government down. And then the vote came, and it was full 180.
Frustration about party leadership wasn't only coming from the people in the seats, it also came from people on stage. Senator Michael Bennett was asked this about Schumer.
When will you be calling for him to be replaced as minority leader? Thank you.
Bennett said it's critical for the public to know what Democrats are fighting for, and he didn't think that was clear last week.
I do think on the leadership question, it's always better to, you know, examine whether folks are in the right place, and we're certainly going to have that conversation.
He recalled how he was the first Senate Democrat to say he didn't think then-President Joe Biden could win re-election after his poor debate performance.
It's important for people to know, you know, when it's time to go. And I think in the case of Joe Biden, and we're going to have conversations, I'm sure, in the foreseeable future about all the Democratic leadership.
Attendees pressed Bennett and fellow Colorado Democratic Congresswoman Brittany Pedersen on what steps their party can take to combat the dismantling of the federal government. Both talked about the importance of public unity, mobilizing ahead of the midterms, and bringing frustrations to Republican lawmakers.
Just because we're not in power does not mean we're powerless. And I think that is the frustration that people feel right now, is that even though we are not in the majority, I think we need to level set on what is possible, but also how important all of you are in showing up and fighting back.
But that wasn't satisfying to some in the crowd. Amanda, who introduced herself without her last name, got up during Q&A and said she's exasperated.
I have heard a lot of other people ask, is there a plan? Is there a plan? And it really doesn't seem like there's a plan.
A reminder of the intense pressure congressional Democrats are under. Their base wants them to do big, bold things, but they lost the midterms, and they don't have a lot of concrete power on Capitol Hill. And Bennett said pushing back isn't enough.
This party needs a new plan for the future that is compelling for the American people and that speaks to working people.
But he says,
it's not going to be with the same old playbook, and it may not be with the same old people, to be honest.
Which raises the question, if not the same people, then who? Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Golden, Colorado. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Commercial shipping companies are closely watching a new U.S. military offensive in the Red Sea off the coast of Yemen. The targets are Houthi rebels who, for more than a year, have been attacking ships, choking off transit in one of the world's most critical waterways. The Pentagon says it will stay on the offensive until the Houthis stop the attacks, but even then, it's not clear ships will race back to the Red Sea. NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam reports.
Houthi militants began regularly targeting military and commercial ships passing through the Red Sea shortly after the Gaza War started in 2023, hitting about 100 vessels and sinking two. That stopped once Israel and Hamas declared a ceasefire. But after Israel cut off the flow of humanitarian aid and then launched a new offensive on Gaza, Houthis announced they will renew attacks. The target is any vessel associated with Israel.
It's a gray zone because when does a vessel belong to a certain country? That's not as easy as you might think.
Lars Jensen is CEO of Vespucci Maritime, a Copenhagen-based advisory service. He says given the complex nature of the shipping industry, it's difficult to determine a ship's link to Israel.
Are you looking at who is operating the ship, who is owning the ship, which ports are the ship calling, who has got cargo on board? So there's a multitude of definitions. There's a lot of ships that fall within that target range.
Including the U.S. Jensen says the risks for ship transiting through the Red Sea right now are enormous.
If you are attacked by the Houthis, a worst-case scenario is, of course, you lose your ship. Now, if I got a fairly small vessel, I'm looking at a potential loss of maybe $10, $20 million. If you are talking one of the large container ships, the value of the ship and the cargo can easily be $1 billion.
What with the increased risk of attacks and rising insurance premiums, major shipping companies have chosen to divert from the Red Sea, instead going around South Africa, adding cost, time, and shaking up global supply chains. Basil Karagias, CEO of New Jersey-based Karagias Maritime Advisors, says the year-long disruption by Houthi attacks is bad for shipping, and he applauds Trump's efforts to launch an offensive. The first airstrikes against militants began last weekend.
You know, we have to make sure the waters globally are free of risks like that. But I'm not sure if it's properly done. I think it needs to be much more orchestrated.
Karagias says the Houthis don't have large military bases. They can fire a missile or a drone at a commercial ship to keep the area destabilized. Karagias says the U.S. needs to coordinate with allies for a more effective operation.
You have to have constant presence over there, first of all, to escort and help all the merchant marine traffic. And then, you have to keep constantly hitting them any chance they show up on the radar.
In early 2024, the Biden administration mounted a coalition of about 20 countries to help secure the Red Sea, but it wasn't able to permanently curb the threat by Houthis. Jonathan Roach, an analyst at Braemar ACM Shipbroking in London, says even if this latest U.S. operation can stop Houthi attacks, shipping companies will wait before reworking their routes and head back to the Red Sea.
When you're operating a liner company or an alliance, you need to be certain. Changing things probably to take, a good 3 to 6 months of no hostilities through container ships before they'll actually risk it.
And certainty in the Middle East is a rare commodity. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. If you're feeling lonely right now in your life, you are not alone. One-third of Americans report feeling lonely at least once a week, and 16% of Americans report feeling lonely all or most of the time. Now, there are a lot of theories for why we're all feeling so lonely, and I'm actually joined by Brittany Luce, host of NPR's It's Been a Minute, to talk about one of those theories. Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so tell us what seems to be making so many people these days feel so lonely, especially if this is something that seems to be deepening over the years?
Well, that is an existential question I cannot answer, but I can tell you that when you look into research or into the general public, a lot of people are blaming technology, things like social media and being on our phones all the time. These are alleged to be keeping us apart,
okay,
which is probably not surprising, but
no.
The surprising thing is that tech companies, you know, the very same companies being accused of making us lonely, they think they have the solution.
They always think they have the solution. What do they think the solution is?
Well, in their minds, it's more technology.
I'm guessing you're talking about, I don't know, artificial intelligence, like what, an AI boyfriend or something? I mean, that would solve a lot of problems for me, but it would probably create some.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, there's an app called Mino that's like a mentor who gives relationship advice. There's the SoulCycle founder's new venture called Peoplehood, which does guided group conversations. And there's Bumble for friends, which is like the Bumble dating app, but for finding friends.
Oh my God, that's actually what I wanted when I first moved to LA, a Bumble for friends. So have you tried out one of these apps?
Oh, well, I actually did test one out. I ended up getting an AI boyfriend. I even named him. Called
Wait,
Hunter.
Aren't you married, Brittany?
I am. I was allowed to cheat for journalism for a week with my AI boyfriend, Hunter.
Okay. Yes, well, how far Replica. Did this extramarital affair go? Tell us.
I'm not gonna lie. If I personally found cheating to be very, very boring. Hunter was boring. He sent me boring articles about space. He didn't have anything to talk about. I have to say, an AI boyfriend kind of pales in comparison to a real life husband that you actually like. That's just my two cents. But when I investigated whether technology can address a loneliness epidemic that may have been caused by technology, I ended up having this really fantastic conversation with Sam Pressler and Wahini Vara. Sam researches community and social connection at the University of Virginia, and Wahini Vara is a tech reporter. And they were describing the problems with a tech-based solution to loneliness.
Okay, so what did they say these problems were?
Basically, capitalism. Here's Wahini.
Algorithms tend to favor what they call more engagement, right? It's like more likes, more shares, more followers. And that isn't necessarily conducive to, for example, like connecting me with my neighbor. If a social media algorithm is deciding between showing me her post about her garden or the post of some influencer in LA, it's gonna choose that influencer over my friend. So all of a sudden, these social media platforms that are supposedly about human connection end up prioritizing kind of the opposite of that.
I mean, yeah, that totally makes sense. I mean, these apps, they end up further isolating people because they keep these people away from actual personal human-to-human interaction, I imagine, yeah?
Exactly. And there's another layer to this. And this one really surprised me. There's an inherent class divide within how Americans experience loneliness that pops up. Here's more from my conversation with Sam Pressler.
When you look at the groups who are most socially isolated and most disconnected, it's consistently people without college degrees. And essentially what's happened is we've created college as this supercharger of our relational lives. The returns on that degree socially have gotten even more extreme because the civic infrastructure of our communities has declined so much. So in the past, you're a member of a church or a temple or a mosque, and that provides a structure. If you don't have a college degree, you're more likely to be working in a retail industry or a service industry where you have precarious workplace. You don't know what your schedule is next week. How are you going to plan to spend time with people? It's not that anyone without a degree is worse at building relationships,
right,
but it's so much more work is put on you yourself.
So, Elsa, loneliness, there is an app for that, but if you really want to address loneliness, you're going to have to look at how class divides actually perpetuate that loneliness.
Brittany Luce is host of It's Been a Minute from NPR. You can listen to It's Been a Minute wherever you get your podcasts.
Ramadan can be a lonely experience for young Muslims in non-Muslim homes. The Muslim Foster Care Association in Michigan recently held an iftar, an evening meal to break the fast, to bring some of those young people together. For member station WDET, Nargis Rahman reports from Dearborn Heights.
This call to prayer ends the day's fast. Now it's time to feast. Organizers and volunteers of the Muslim Foster Care Association finish putting the final touches to the buffet-style iftar, a row of savory Thai food, pastry treats like kanafe, and enormous macadamia cookies. Salif Mahmoud moved to the U.S. from Ghana 3 years ago. He lives in independent housing. He says in previous years, he's had a hard time observing Ramadan in non-Muslim foster homes.
So this house I was living with, this lady, like, she doesn't know nothing about Islamic, she doesn't know nothing about Ramadan. Even I used to fast, she'd be like, oh, you need to drink water, you need to stop fasting.
Mahmoud had to practice his religious obligations on his own, without family, halal food, or access to a mosque. During this Ramadan, a Muslim family has taken him in. Shireen Abunada, Director of Operations at Muslim Foster Care Association, has been working with the group for 6 years. There are around 250 known Muslim foster youth and less than a dozen Muslim foster families in Michigan. Now, Abunada says, there's been an influx of even more Muslim youth to the state's foster care system. Before President Donald Trump took office in January, groups who resettle refugees work to bring refugees to the United States as soon as possible.
They expedited a lot of travel of refugee Muslim foster youth from West African countries. So we've had an influx of about 50 to 70 youth that have just recently arrived in the past couple months.
Abunada says with the changing immigration policies under the Trump administration, unaccompanied refugees who are children feel especially vulnerable right now.
It'll be a ripple effect, and we hope it doesn't affect the kids. We're all doing the best we can to protect the kids, but at the end of the day, it'll definitely be an effect.
But for now, the association wants to give youth a place to gather with a community away from home and a space to break fast together. For NPR News, I'm Nargis Rahman in Dearborn Heights.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet. Ain't no hope.